Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, state number 401, August the 10th, 1979, and it's side one. On tape number 398, that was just several weeks ago, July 20th, I talked about Maurice Keenan, who escaped from the killing of Robert Opel, the very political gay activist in the San Francisco area that I thought he had links to the police department or to the higher-ups in the Dan White operation. He was the man who was killed. Opel was mocking the Dan White trial and handing out handbills in San Francisco about that trial, and then he was gunned down point blank. The man who shot him was arrested at the San Francisco airport in the company of two other people involved in the crime. He was taken to San Francisco, walked out of the jail. They alerted his father nearby that the police were supposed to look for him and stake out the house. They didn't do that. And he went in there. He could pick up plane tickets or money or shave. And the police not only took off the handcuffs in the jail after he was wanted for a serious crime of blowing somebody's head off at point blank, but he walked away with money evidently to get down, or had an escape car to get down to his father's place and change. When he was picked up at the airport, he was on his way to Miami. He has been arrested in Miami. He was picked up there, and now they're trying extradition hearings to see if he'll be sent back. There's not much about him in the news. He was arrested in Miami, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of a trial he has. There was a big controversy in San Francisco, a dispute between the district attorney, Joe Freitas, and the sheriff, Eugene Brown. Two deputies were suspended, and because of the Freitas links to Jonestown and Dan White and that can of worms in the political atmosphere up there, I imagine he was embarrassed to see this Maurice Keenan walk away. There isn't very much in the news, as I say, so we'll just follow that as it comes. Last week, I talked about the CIA and the testing, that educational testing service in Princeton that screens out people to work in corporations or as accountants or through the employment block, the higher education levels and the lower education, the graduate work in college and also the undergraduate college work, and then the professional tests, whether it's real estate boards or whatever, how these tests are made up by a select clique of people in New Jersey. The bulk of the tests are made up there. And the CIA helps in the testing program, and there's agents of the CIA even helping screen out these questions. Well, this week there was an article, a UPI story, that the CIA was hinting at secret work, and they ran an ad in the Washington Post asking for people who want to work in professional opportunities. And they reminded people, according to the Washington Post in the ad, that this agency is, in quotes, an equal opportunity employer. It's time for us to know more about each other, it said. And it had lettering with a background of an eagle, and it didn't specify which agent, but applicants got the idea that they were for covert posts in the CIA. Then the ad goes on, there aren't many of you, one in a thousand maybe, you are bright, self-reliant, self-motivated, a person we need to help us gather information in a meaningful picture of what's happening in the world. You can rely on your wits, your initiative, and your skills, and in return, enjoy recognition, positions of responsibility in life in foreign places. Then the ad specifies it only wants college graduates, American citizens, and foreign language aptitude. Well, you see, that's the catch-22 of the educational testing system that we talked about last week, because they begin by saying we are an equal opportunity agency, but we want you bilingual people with language opportunities who are very witty, who have a lot of skills, and are college graduates. But how do you get into the colleges, the major schools that have aptitude tests, or the prep schools that teach you languages? Give the individual a preference. I know my two boys went to prep schools, private schools. Their father insisted on it at the time, and I refused to let the girls go through that kind of a training, but he was adamant that they do that because he claimed it is a better opportunity for them in quotes, colleges and professionally, end quotes. And so they started learning French when they were little, and then Latin, and then Spanish. And then David went on to do Russian language, and then went on to for a degree, professional degree after that. But children who have that opportunity do have foreign language aptitudes, and the point is that the agency claims to be equal opportunity, but it immediately screens out all but a certain percentage of the population, because the other things it's looking for, the underprivileged, can't fall into that category, and that's what basically keeps those agencies lily white, which is what they want in the first place. That's why they're helping write the questions to the test so they can screen out the people that they don't want. Our friend Warren Berger is beginning to show his ugly little head. Last week on the tape, I talked about the death of Rexville Tugwell and the new constitution that is sitting in mothballs waiting to be used, and the key person in the legal department of the Bill of Rights was Warren Berger, making sure there'd be no trial by jury. Just this week, August the 7th, as luck would have it, New York Times, here's Chief Justice Warren Berger's idea for complex court cases. Chief Justice Warren Berger proposes that the federal and state judges study the elimination of juries in civil cases because they're just too complicated and technical for laymen. He says the justice is approaching a highly controversial legal issue, the denial of trial by jury. And he says now we have to decide about using juries for covering these criminal cases. His long excuse is it would be cumbersome for a plumber or electrician to compel him to serve on a jury for 5 to 6 months, only making $30 a day. But that's where the racism and the elitism is, that the poor identify with the poor, and only the retired military and the older people are sure to sit on the juries, and that's what happens in our area. I don't know about yours. If you see these juries, they are retired from the Defense Department, the Post Office Department, and so forth. So on the excuse that we're depriving the working class of their day's wages, we keep the working class off the jury, but primarily the trials are of poor, working class, or unemployed poor, and therefore they're never tried among a group of their peers because those peers already have a set income and aren't interested in having these people employed or much less have justice. But it's interesting, last week when I was talking about that constitution and Warren Berger, because he's coming out now and saying that some cases are just too complicated, they're too sophisticated, only an economist could grasp it. The average person could understand it very well if the evidence was presented to them in a way that a person was either guilty or innocent. The average person would understand it just fine, but he wants to squeeze them out and not have a trial by jury in many cases because he doesn't think that they're able to understand. It would be unfair to the defendant because the average person couldn't understand the lingo. The expertise of the law profession is written like in Latin or Greek, so you're not supposed to understand it, and the terms and the sentencing and so forth is so vague. If it were equal across the board that everybody who commits the same crime gets the same sentencing, but again, like in the case of Dan White, they can wrangle over and over the intent to kill, even though he went through a metal detector, reloaded the gun, aimed it point blank, hated the person to begin with, walks in and knows full well what he did. The jury, in that case, again, was not plumbers and electricians. It was people from Bechtel Corporation, and Bechtel had given money for Dan White when he ran on the board of supervisors, a retired person from the Army and the one from the IRS, many government employees involved with that jury. So Warren Berger just is coming out 1 week after I referred to his lack of trial by jury as being fair and giving the flimsiest excuses for what would continue to be a legal ripoff of the court system. Jimmy Carter told his Sunday school class this week that he tried to convert South Korean President Park Chung-hee to Christianity and that the rest is in God's hands. He probably translated the message was, "We'll leave the troops in South Korea if you become a Christian." But here's a man who's the leader of a large group of people other than the Christian church, and he has effrontery to visit that country and said, "We want you to be a Christian." Here's the leader of a Buddhist nation. They have 2 million Christians and 36.5 million population. So So except for those 2 million, the other 34.5 are Buddhists or non-Christians. And Jimmy Carter cannot accept the differences. He thinks it's his duty, he said, to convert to Christianity, and that's why he went there. He had the responsibility to bring in new followers. It's that mentality that I feel will do away with the Jewish religion in this country within 8 to 10 years if it keeps up, because of the intense mobilization of the Christian movement and the born-again Christian movement. And the President of the United States, when he goes to somebody like that and tries to get them to convert to Christianity, you know what he thinks of Jews, and I don't think they would have much chance under the trilateralists or the Reagan government that would come into power when this administration is over. And if we escalate to this level of fascism, the whole world will be converted to Christianity, the thing that they wanted in the Inquisition and the Middle Ages, Adolf Hitler wanted. I see it very easily coming about now, what's happening over in Israel. And this, the mentality or the state of mind of Jimmy Carter trying to pull this thing, means that this movement that's being funded for billions of dollars to turn the whole world Christian could happen if the president pursued it in this way. One of the most scandalous disappearing acts took place this week. That was Michele Sindona. Those Sindona is the Italian financier who's under indictment because of a collapsing bank, the largest in U.S. history. He'd been living in New York City, and he's missing now. There's a trial to come up for Mr. Sindona's financial manipulations. He was called the financial advisor to Pope Paul VI, and just at the time the trial was to begin, federal trial, September the 10th, he's allegedly kidnapped, which, of course, you don't believe for a minute. I don't believe for a minute. But by saying he's kidnapped, they can pass off that $3 million personal bond that was on Mr. Sindona. He had some legal staff in Milan, I believe. A lawyer, prosecution lawyer, was supposed to have been killed just last week. I won't do too much on Sindona, because those of you who have the tapes, 364, that's November the 24th, 1978, about 8 months ago, have the tape and the sheet on Sindona, the politics of investment in the Vatican, the work that he did with Pope Paul VI, investing around the world in Luxembourg banks, in Gulf and Western, which is Paramount Pictures, General Motors, General Electric, and the Continental Banks of Illinois, his work with CREEP, the Committee to Reelect the President. Sindona had offered a large contribution, $1 million, to Marie Stand's committee to reelect Nixon. And Sindona is very instrumental in meeting with Montini and the Mormon Mafia. This was the link of Vatican to organized crime and investments. And he came to this country, he's only 58 years old, and he was named in a 99-count indictment as of last March because he acquired the Franklin National Bank in 1972, and he was removed illegally from the banks he controlled in Milan at the time. He acquired that bank and is co-defendant. There's an indictment of $45 million of misapplication of $45 million from the Franklin National Funds, and $30 million of it is in losses resulting from foreign exchange speculations. He was living in the Pier Hotel in New York City, quite comfortable, on a $3 million bond, and now he's supposed to be missing for the September trial. I imagine he'll either be found dead or they'll keep him in hiding, because certainly it would be difficult for the Vatican and the Republican Party and CREEP and the powers that be in the hierarchy of the United States cabinet and so forth to get into this Mr. Sindona. He's a slippery one who's tied up to the highest levels of organized crime, the Milan Mafia, Montini, who returned in June 21st, 63, as Pope Paul VI, and he brought with him from Milan experts, financiers, publishers, designers, art people. And just a few months before John Kennedy was killed, Pope Paul VI from the OSS was in charge of the Vatican. And then this Sindona came along and took the Vatican money to invest it in the United States. There were secret meetings and I had quite a bit on that tape, and I have a lot more if you want it. But his trial September the 1st, and this is August, and now they say that he's kidnapped. Kidnapped without a scream or a bra, who the guy where he walked out and probably flew away with other identification. It'll be interesting to see where he is, but we might have known he'd never have a trial. There was a parallel escape, incidentally involving the same people that worked with Sindona and Pope Paul VI. This had to do at the time of the Air West trial, when stockholders were claiming that the stock had been manipulated and brought down to be bought at a lower price by the Howard Hughes empire. Just when this huge trial was going to take place in Reno, Nevada, a witness, George Crockett, was missing. And the defendants, of course, in the trial were Robert Mayhew, Chester Davis, and David Charney of the Hughes Corporation. And Robert Mayhew, of course, worked with these teams, the Mullen office that was funded at the time of the 1972 elections, the re-elections of the president, had to do with CREEP, the Committee to Re-elect the President, and Vatican money. And, of course, Robert Mayhew's agents, or the Hughes organization, Mayhew had worked for the Hughes organization, and Bennett's office was the recipient of these CREEP funds, even though Mayhew at that time had a space between Howard Hughes organization and himself. He was a part of that entire counterintelligence operation at one stage or another, at least at the time the assassination teams were hired. The multimillion dollar trial was put off for 1 month, and then it had to be stopped because, according to Judge Bruce Thompson, the U.S. attorneys had 1 month to track down the missing witness, critical to the government case, and they didn't find him. George Crockett was a Hughes associate, and he was the most important witness to the fact that there was a conspiracy to force stockholders to sell Air West short, to drop the stock down in order for a takeoff at the purchase. Now, Mr. Crockett was the owner of Alamo Airways, that run an operation at McCarran International Airport in Reno, and so he could make an easy getaway, don't you think? And because he was the main witness trial in this case and never showed up, for the time being, that trial was dropped. All charges were dropped, and they said that the reason they had to do it was because their primary witness wasn't there. So Mr. Sindona is gone at a time when the same power bases would be challenged or whittled away, just as Mr. Crockett disappeared when the defendants from the Hughes organization were going to be tried on a conspiracy to manipulate the stock. That's the fun of studying history, is that it repeats itself over and over again. And if you save the files and watch what happens in one case, you'll be sure that they're able to pull it the second and the third and the fourth time around. I just read an article today where one man hung himself in a jail cell, and 11 other men in the cell, it was a large holding cell, watched him do it and didn't stop him. And they said they didn't want to get involved. And he was in there for a $10 robbery and died in that cell. Another man was bound down by his ankles and feet and died of cancer. And he was charged with a robbery and wasn't convicted. And they knew it and made him die in that cell for some small amount of money. The judge ordered them to remove the leg hold on him because he couldn't even walk out of the room. He was so sick and dying, and the hospital refused to do it. So the poor, you know, for pennies of robberies, $10 or $50 or $100, are given this kind of treatment, and yet these people who are working in the millions and the multi-millions and into the billions and forcing banks to close and conniving with hunks of money that people can't even visualize, we could just talk about it, can just walk away from the case, and the judge drops it for lack of evidence. Speaking of unfair cases, and life certainly doesn't have its equalities, there's a large article of Charles Manson, the anniversary of the Manson killings in 1969, and he picture him in the jail cell, alone, a little square box, and he doesn't leave the cell, and he just stays in that one room and keeps himself for the most part and is not given any psychological treatment to help him get out of this bind. I suppose he'll be there all of his life. The large article about him in the paper this week said it's a good thing that Charles Manson didn't get into prison in the early 70s when the CIA was doing mind control and programming, and yet the tragedy was that they got to him before they ever let him out of jail. He was programmed and given money and buses and vans and set up in a military-type operation. They did get to him, and the author of the article covers that up. It's too bad he got to prison so early because they could have done a mind job on him later. The mind jobs are still going on in the prison. I got two calls today about that. Nothing has stopped, and they're still going on with the mind control jobs in the prison. But alongside of the article of Charlie Manson, who I always identified with, I felt sorry for him because his potential and what he could have been and the kind of life he had, even though he was a neo-Nazi or a racist, I felt that Charlie had some things going for him that were perverted and turned around. But the man who did all the killings at Sharon Tate's house and stabbed her pregnant stomach and tore out the baby and wrote death to the pigs, you know, with blood on the door, and then the next night went to the LaBiancas and cut them up and stuffed knives and forks in their stomachs and killed them. That man, Charles Watson, just became engaged. He married a woman. He plans to marry a woman. He's a chaplain down at San Luis Obispo. He's marrying a woman called Christine Sveig, and he describes her as a born-again Christian, and he wants to get out. He's the person who did the seven stabbings and killings. Charlie Manson wasn't even in those homes to do those killings. He never stepped foot inside the threshold, but Charles Watson did the killings, yet he can have conjugal visits, be engaged, get married, and he even said on TV, he can be interviewed on TV, that he wants to get out of prison because he has connections in organized crime. So someday the killer will be out, and Hitler used those kind of killers. I have a book called The Jekylls, how Hitler used known criminals or mass murderers in his army and as guards for concentration camps. But Manson, who didn't do those murders at Sharon Tate and LaBianca's house, was charged with hypnotizing or controlling them to do it, but he didn't do it himself. He's in a little tiny cell, 8 by 10 or whatever, maybe smaller than that, just enough for a cot and a toilet. But Charles Watson has all the luxuries and comforts at San Luis Obispo, a fiancé now, a born-again Christian, and he's chaplain and meets people and socializes, and you'll see that he'll be out soon. It won't be long. The CIA is gathering up energy for its new charter, just as the Warren Burger system wants a new justice system without trial by jury. The Republican National Committee is bringing up for the convention in 1980 a proposition to end confusion and chaos in foreign policy. This is from the Washington Post. It said the intelligence community has deteriorated since Nixon, Ford, and Carter. All it means is that the intelligence community became exposed, and they're asking in a new charter that they tighten up and reduce information made public under the Freedom of Information and Privacy Act. I don't know how they can reduce it when they hardly give it out. I've written to them, and of course the FBI, I've gotten about 20 pages of a report, but I know, with the exception of the three things they talked about, there's much more in the last 7 or 8 years that I've done regarding the CIA and the FBI. But they want to stop that freedom of information, and they want laws to protect the agents, of course, make them be punished if they give out information or squeal on what's going on. And these proposals are to strengthen the clandestine operations abroad and reduce the information that people can have at home. And that is going to be one of the issues at the 1980 convention. The Republican National Convention is a strong intelligence apparatus. That's pretty ironic, since the way the Republicans would have gotten in power is through the succession of murders in the first place of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and various civil rights leaders, in addition to Martin Luther King, like Malcolm X and Medgar Evers. And, well, it goes on and on. The deaths that have resulted in the shooting of George Wallace, the killing of Mary Jo Kopechne, every one of these election violences was for the Republicans to succeed. As a matter of fact, Anthony Sutton was on KGO this week talking about his book on the Trilateralists, and he was telling how in the summer of 72, The Trilateral Commission was set up with David Rockefeller, and by 73 they were briefing Jimmy Carter on what to do if he were their candidate for president. By 73, 74, their team was all set. But James McCord was separate from the other Watergaters, and there were a lot of allegations that he worked for Rockefeller or was a spy inside the Watergate camp. And the point is that after he blew the whistle on all these other people, and Richard Nixon and then Gerald Ford followed him, it cleared the way for Jimmy Carter and the Trilateralists to get into office, and also for the oil people to be making $7 million a day profit, which is what they wanted from Jimmy Carter. They got their investment, they have their billions of profits, and that's pretty good. He paid off in just a few years what they wanted. That's why he doesn't look nervous. People think he's faltering or falling apart. He's got a meaner, darker, stronger team than ever to serve the people that put him in. But as soon as the Scotch tape was on the door that embarrassed Nixon and got him out and Ford, and it brought in Haig to take a view of the Oval Office and the White House, we then ended up with Brzezinski and the Trilateralists and David Rockefeller very much in control. So I'm not sure that the Nixon-Ford-Carter succession wasn't due to James McCord working for this team that has this immense power. Sutton was talking about Mr. Bush, another candidate for president, being a member of the Trilateral Commission, and the overlapping of this group with the Council of Foreign Relations. So the regathering of the Republican Party in 1980, asking for a strong, more secret intelligence operation, is to give them back the muscles for the assassination teams that they've used to get their power since 1963. Only the Republicans and the Trilaterals, I don't call Jimmy Carter, with his appointments and his stature and his meetings with the Bilderbergers and the Brzezinski Kissinger clique, I don't call him a Democrat. He's an interim president serving so that the Trilaterals will have a member of their organization in the White House, or at least controlling him. So they want their secrecy. The Republicans are strong on this, and this is the very group that benefited the most from the drownings, the shootings, and the assassinations. There are a few other items in the news that I think are interesting. One has to do with a scandal-ridden hotel in Las Vegas, card and dice games and slot machines and gambling activities. They shut down the Hotel Aladdin. The U.S. District Court voted in to shut that in Las Vegas for investigations on their activities. But the attorney for the Aladdin Hotel that wants the reopening of the Las Vegas resort is none other than Ramsey Clark. He came out for a while and tried to show his liberal wings, but he's the attorney general who said there was no conspiracy in the Martin Luther King assassination, and he was also in the Justice Department putting down Jim Garrison and praising Clay Shaw at the time that Jim Garrison had a lawsuit. So given enough time, these people fall into place, and Ramsey Clark tried during the Vietnamese War and through other meetings to put on this liberal cloak, but he's now in Vegas, right where he belongs, with the mafia, organized crime gambling syndicate of one way or another, and he's representing them out in Vegas. Interesting place for a member of the Justice Department. Also, another article in the paper this week, the laser is the new weapon in a war game arsenal, and this comes from Palms Marine Base, 29 Palms Marine Base down near Palm Springs, that they're using laser guns for weapons. The laser will remove the guesswork, and it will help them determine who gets killed. It will be like a friendly force pitted against a platoon-sized aggressor force to use the amazing laser beam with authenticity. When I talked about laser beams in New York City just 2 years ago, Mark Lane was screaming how irresponsible I was to even think that the government would use laser beams. There's another Associated Press story this week about space-to-space warfare that the Space and Missile Systems Organization, headquartered in Los Angeles, has a $2.5 billion annual budget for space warfare. That's their budget, $2.5 billion annually. We are living in a treacherous time. More about that on the other side of this tape.